Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Hello, good morning. How are you? On the programme between now and 12, fire in Navan apartment block leaves up to 100 temporarily without a home. Medieval monument at Glendalough damaged in an act of possible vandalism. A new strain of COVID now accounts for 1 in 7 cases in Britain. And why 4,000 rather than 10,000 steps a day might do. Hedging against a second Trump presidency, diplomats working overtime in embassies around the world, and 100 years since this state's first election. Professor Diarmaid Ferriter on the vote that took the violence out of the Civil War but perpetuated the conflict. Text us this morning on 51551, or you can also email todaycb@rte.ie. The Police Service of Northern Ireland, as you heard in the headlines, has apologised for a data leak which it says could cause incalculable damage after mistakenly revealing details of all its 10,000 staff. In response to a Freedom of Information request, the PSNI had shared names of police and civilian personnel, where they were based and their roles. The details were then published online before being removed. For more on this, I'm joined on the line now by Mike Nesbitt, former Ulster Unionist Party leader and the party's representative on the policing board. Good morning, Mike. Thanks very much for talking to us. Can I get you to revert to your former role of journalist first, please, and give us the detail that you have heard on how this happened?
Yes, good morning, Philip. As I understand it, it was a regular Freedom of Information request asking for numbers of police officers and staff, their rank or grade, if they were civilians, what they did and where they were based. Now, this information was on a spreadsheet, and the mistake was uploading the spreadsheet because behind the initial facts and figures was the source data on a semi-hidden tab. And that is how that information has come to be released. The Freedom of Information request was perfectly fine, regular, legitimate. The headline answer was similarly regular and legitimate. The problem was the person who uploaded the information didn't realise that behind that headline they were actually uploading all the source, the names, the surnames, the initials, the place of work and what they were doing.
And where was it published and how long did it remain online?
It was published on a Freedom of Information site. I think it's called What They Do. It's a well-known site. It was up for a couple of hours. And one of the questions that I'm going to be asking when the police come to the policing board in 24 hours' time is how did they find out that this had happened? Because they're saying this is how it happened. But I'm yet to learn how they found out that it happened and they moved to correct it. They are, of course, also saying that it was human error, but they're also saying it can't happen again. Now, when they say it can't happen again, I guess they're saying we will no longer upload spreadsheets. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the human condition is full of human error. You cannot stop human error. You can maybe put in more processes to try and guard against it. But you definitely cannot do away with human error. That is part of our condition.
Name, rank, role and station they are assigned to. Not home address, not emails or phone numbers or any details like that. Now, one of the differences between the north and the south of this island is that information like that would routinely be released on members of An Garda Síochána Síochána in publications like the Garda Review when a guard moves from one station to another. Why is it much more dangerous? Why are these individuals much more vulnerable in Northern Ireland?
Because the threat level in Northern Ireland was recently raised to severe. That's the highest level. It means a terrorist attack is highly likely. And of course, it follows on the attempted murder of Detective Chief Inspector John Caldwell back in February when he was running a course for some young footballers at a sports centre in Oma. And two gunmen approached him and left him with life-changing, life-altering injuries. He was actually lucky to escape his life. And I think what really spooked the police about that attack is that they're used to, as it were, remote attacks on police officers. In other words, the likes of an undercar bomb, which is detonated remotely. In this case, you had the attempted murderers up close and personal to DCI Caldwell, and that's new in recent times. And as I say, that's kind of spooked the police. And that's why security is such an issue. And what I'll be looking for tomorrow is a realistic assessment from the police of the threat level to the 10,799 names on that list, because I believe that the threat level will not be uniform. Mm. So, for example, I think there'd be a difference between, say, a civilian working at a desk at police headquarters and a police officer who might be working undercover looking at organised crime. So we need to be realistic about this, because these are real people and they are suffering very severe distress with the news of this leak.
And in your policing board role, you have presumably, before this leak, spoken to members of the PSNI who wouldn't, in the ordinary course of events, be particularly happy about their details being made public.
Oh, yes. I mean, we talk about single identity groups in Northern Ireland, you know, in terms of, for example, groups of victims and survivors of the conflict who like to work with people who have similar experiences, similar backgrounds. So you would have, for example, groups who would be particularly and exclusively ex-Royal Ulster Constabulary groups. So, yeah, people are very precious about guarding their information. So this will have come as deeply shocking, incredibly surprising that it's happened, and the implications mm-hmm. are potentially massive.
And people who have not revealed to their extended families what it is that they do for a living.
I had one correspondent last night on an email saying he hasn't had dinner in his mother's house for over 10 years because he's a police officer and he doesn't think he can tell her that he works with the PSNI. Last week at a policing board event, I met an officer who said there's at least one close relative of theirs who she feels she cannot tell. She's in the police because of the reaction it would get. And she also said she knew of a couple who have since separated, but one didn't know that the other was in the PSNI. I think that's an incredible way to live your life.
Indeed. Stay with us if you can, please, Mike Nesbitt. I'm joined also by Sam McBride, Northern Ireland editor of the Belfast Telegraph and Sunday Independent. Sam, have you been talking to members of the PSNI since this broke? What's the reaction been?
Good morning, Philip. Yes, I have. There was a serving officer who contacted me last night and said that his own family don't know that he's a police officer. There are people who have spent years living very discreet, careful lives, cultivating a particular persona as to what they do, and they have had that blown apart in an instant by their own organisation. That's why this is so significant. It's not simply that there are the names of officers here, but it says where they work, and not just in terms of where they work as a location, but the type of work that they do. So people who work with MI5, the British spy agency, there are almost 40 names of people who are based at their Northern Ireland headquarters in Holyrood, County Down. I mean, that is about as sensitive police information as you can get beyond getting into things like who are their informers, etc. It's really, really problematic that those people's names are out there.
There is also a financial implication to people's data being revealed and made public, isn't there?
Well, there are already lawyers circling. Within hours of this last night, there were solicitors I know who were contacting people, who were being contacted by police officers, asking what their rights were here. There will potentially be two elements of vulnerability on the financial front for the police. The first is with the Information Commissioner's Office, which is the UK body that polices data protection. It can impose very large fines, I think up to about 4% of an organisation's budget. That would be for the most serious breaches. So that could be at least many millions, but then far more significant potentially are individual officers who, if, for instance, say they are forced to move house, move to a different location, etc., are they able to claim that that is as a direct result of this? Well, I think there's at the very least an arguable case, given that the PSNI accepts that this is such a significant security issue. Is all of that bill ultimately going to come back onto the police? Well, if it is, it's a massive problem. The police budget is already broken. The chief constable has said that his budget has been cut so much next year that some basic tasks of policing will not be able to function. This is an organisation in crisis, and it's questionable now as to whether the chief constable himself will be able to survive this.
Yes, on that, Mike Nesbitt, the PSNI is, as Sam says, already operating in the red to the tune of £38 million. Can the leadership of the PSNI remain intact?
Well, I'm not a fan of a knee-jerk reaction. Having said that, Simon Byrne is the accounting officer, so the buck does stop with him. But I think there are questions to be asked of the senior executive team, in other words, Simon and his senior colleagues. Sam is right to point out the financial implications here. The police are saying that making all the cuts that they can possibly make, they still are short of £38 million in terms of their budget, and they simply can't rectify that. As well as the potential fine to the organisation, under the General Data Protection Regulations, GDPR, Article 82 makes clear that any individual whose information is leaked is liable, can have compensation. And I've been looking online and it says, you know, around about £2,000 is the going rate. I think people will consider that very small beer for their personal details being leaked. But as you're talking over 10,000 people, you know, if they all got £2,000, you're talking 20 million. So this financially is potentially utterly disastrous for the PSNI. But I go back to my original point that the focus has to be on the 10,799 individuals who are suffering unexpected distress because of this leak.
Can I move you on to another issue, please, before I let you go, Mike Nesbitt? On Taoiseach Leo Varadkar is set to meet political leaders in Belfast later on. He has been critical of Downing Street in remarks that he made to the Financial Times, saying that while a closer partnership was crucial to restoring power sharing, there had been a reluctance by the British government to, quote, go down that route. I presume that your party, the UEP, is not expecting a major breakthrough today.
No, no, we're not expecting a major breakthrough. But I think in terms of fixing things, I go back to the spirit of 1998 and the agreement, which was based on relationships, the relationships which John Hume famously divided into the three strands, the internal relationships within Northern Ireland, the relationships north-south, and then the relationships east-west. And I think post-Brexit, the emphasis on improving relationships east-west is more important than it has ever been over the last 25 years. So if Taoiseach is saying that the government in London isn't doing all that it can to make sure those relationships are the best that they can be, that is something we need to take extremely seriously, because we want the best relationships possible between Belfast, Dublin and London.
Mike Nesbitt of the EUP and Sam McBride, thank you very much. I want to stay with this story, though, from a cybersecurity point of view, and talk to Paul C. Dwyer, president of the International Cyber Threat Task Force. Good morning to you, Paul. As you've just heard, the names of 40 MI5 officers and where they're stationed being part of the data included in this leak. The information was removed from the internet within a couple of hours at being realised that a mistake had been made. But will it have been cached? How easy would it be for a malign actor to go and get their hands on those names?
Yeah, to be honest, it's going to be pretty straightforward for any bad actor, as we refer to them, to be able to get a copy of this data. When something goes out on the internet, it's there forever, and it will have left digital footprints. This is akin to if somebody was trying to work out the PSNI as an organisation, this is like somebody giving away all the edge pieces of a jigsaw. And it's then very easy for cyber threat actors, whether they're criminal or whether they're terrorist-related actors that want to understand that organization, to follow their own methodologies, such as doxing, to build up that full picture. As Mike alluded to there about the attacks on officers and them coming almost from a social engineering perspective, this is the kind of information, this is the kind of data that can be weaponized by those who want to do harm to the PSNI.
And all because somebody didn't know how to operate an Excel spreadsheet properly, one assumes. How common, how easy an error is that to make?
This is down to the cybersecurity culture of an organization. And culture is a direct result of policies and procedures, which is a direct result of leadership. So this is all about leadership and the culture of an organization on how it adheres to and how trust is established in that organization around protecting all kinds of digital assets. This is the genesis of this is either the lack of or the failure of a control, which is probably around something very basic and mundane like cybersecurity training. There are so many alarms going off here as to why this happened, how it was allowed to happen, because there should have been so many checks and balances to make sure it did not happen.
Like what? How complicated a set of regulations and checks and balances are you talking about, or can it be done easily?
Well, it could be done easily because, I mean, why is the source data in a tab with the data that they wanted to publicly disseminate? I mean, that's ludicrous to have them in the same file, in a relatively insecure format of a file in Excel spreadsheet. Traditionally, this kind of information, certainly of a sensitive nature, with MI5 agents and such like, would be held in different, more secure systems. There would be encryption protocols used. There'd be authorization levels before that kind of information could be accessed, used. And the freedom of information request at the end of the day was for high-level, headline, meta kind of data. Why is it so closely in the same sheet as something else? I mean, we wouldn't have a list of our own passwords or sensitive data in the same list as we had a shopping list. I mean, you know, it's sensitive information, and it should have had the respect and the protections around that.
This might sound like a very juvenile level solution, but is the answer in this case as simple as just making a PDF of a file before you send it out, rather than ever opening up the possibility of giving people access to the raw data?
The answer truly is fundamentally education, because whether the technological answer may have involved other technologies, for example, like a PDF, which wouldn't have really helped that much in this case. But it's more about the checks and balances, more about the process here, Phil. It's more about making sure that there's authorization and sign-off as to what kind of data is accessed by who and for what reason.
But the higher up you go in an organization, Paul, the less technologically adept people tend to be. Is sign-off really a help?
Well, sign-off is part of a procedure. So that doesn't necessarily have to be signed off by the C-level in an organization, but the policy should be signed off, and the procedures that support that policy should be signed off. And that becomes then the operational code and the methodologies and protocols of how the PSNI handles data within the organization. The people who are the front line, the people who made the mistake, quote-unquote, they're following whatever procedures they were trained, presumably. They're following whatever procedures were there. And if they're handed or given a spreadsheet that has all of this data in a second tab, this may have been a civilian, we don't know. This could have been somebody that was only part-time, not even knowledgeable of the consequences of what they had their hands on when this breach occurred. So this is fundamentally always driven by leadership to set the right tone, the right culture, the right procedures and policies, and then they're operated within an organization. You need strategy to drive the operational behavior of an organization, especially something as complex and vast as the PSNI, and especially with budgetary constraints and so on. It's about making sure that these kind of things don't happen.
Paul C. Dwyer of the International Cyber Threat Task Force, thank you very much.
Text 51551 today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.